Welcome back into Midday. My name's Gabe Ortiz, filling in for Tom Hall. Coming up tomorrow, Tom Hall is back in the host chair. Isabel Cumming, the city inspector general, joins Tom to discuss taking Mayor Brandon Scott to court over access to city records. On today's show, we turn to one of the biggest stories in Maryland politics, redistricting. WIPR's State House reporter Sarah Petrowich has been covering every stage of this story, working very hard, maybe to the point of exhaustion. We're going to find out right now as she joins us in Studio A. Sarah, how are we feeling today?
Pretty good. Always a pleasure to be on. Thank you, Gabe.
Always a pleasure to have you on. So for listeners who may not be following state politics very closely, can you explain why redistricting has been such a big story in the news over the past weeks, maybe even months now at this point?
Absolutely. Yeah, this really started last summer whenever President Trump called on Texas and other Republican states to redistrict in favor of Republicans in an effort to gain some House seats to keep Republicans majority after the 2026 election. So there's a couple of Democratic states that are making waves in order to try to counter those efforts, and now Maryland could be one of them. In fact, Governor Wes Moore is really advocating for Maryland to be one of them, as well as some other high-profile Democrats. The idea is that Maryland could redraw its map, which currently favors Democrats 7-1, to favor it 8-0, and it would oust its sole Republican seat. So now the question is, can Maryland make that happen before the election?
And that sole Republican seat belongs to Andy Harris, who is the one Republican representative, as Sarah just said, and this would add just one seat to the Democrats. And in the grand scheme of things, how important is that one seat?
Yeah, that question has been floated a lot. You know, some people are arguing that one seat really could make the difference when it comes to a majority in the House. Some people disagree. Senate President Bill Ferguson is the top Democrat that's really keeping this map at bay. It has passed the Maryland House and it is sitting in purgatory in the Senate. And Bill Ferguson is arguing that there's a procedure that could make this map end up being redrawn to actually lose ground. So he's arguing that 7 Democrats being sent to Congress is enough. And if we get the courts involved, there could be a chance that we could be sending 2 Republicans on behalf of Maryland, which as a top Democrat, obviously Ferguson is saying would be counterproductive. But that's a different legal interpretation or opinion than Governor Wes Moore or some other Democrats. So yeah, there's definitely some division within the party over this.
And the 2026 election is obviously going to be a very important one for both parties. Can you speak a little bit to how thin the margins seem to be going into 2026, and particularly as it pertains to Maryland, with the fact that just one or two seats swinging is leading to a months-long debate now that's involving the Senate president, that's involving the governor, is involving even some national figures that we're going to get to in just a couple minutes here. But, I mean, this has really been taking up a lot of the airtime down in Annapolis. I mean, as somebody who has reported in multiple different states, have you ever seen anything like this?
No, I think, in fact, there are states, actually, this case has been made recently as these discussions are coming up, that early redistricting is really nothing new. And actually, some of the Democrats that are in support, Democratic lawmakers in Maryland that are in support of this new map, have said that there are other states that early redistrict, and there hasn't really been a fair look taken at, is this constitutional? Is this something we should pursue as a country? And so, yeah, you know, there's kind of that question of how much is this about the outcome of the election versus keeping democracy intact. You know, that's what a lot of Democrats are arguing is, hey, well, if Republicans are going to early redistrict, you know, this is Governor Wes Moore's main argument, then we should at least be a part of the conversation, is what he's saying. So yeah, the margins are definitely slim. And in fact, right now, it's almost seeming like this redistricting arms race between all the Republican Democratic states could end up being a wash in theory, that really that no seats are necessarily going to be, there's going to be no net gain necessarily. So it'll be definitely interesting to see how it plays out.
Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives, made his way to Annapolis to advocate for redistricting. He spoke to reporters after meeting with Democratic leadership, including Governor Moore and Senate President Bill Ferguson. He was asked if he thought he had changed Ferguson's mind, and here's what he had to say.
I'm going to let the Senate President speak for himself, and obviously he's got a responsibility in leading the caucus, and he'll continue to do that. We made clear our view that a strong, forceful Democratic response is necessary to the unprecedented efforts by Donald Trump and Republicans to gerrymander congressional maps in red states across the country with the sole intention of rigging the midterm elections.
Again, that was the minority leader of the House of Representatives, Hakeem Jeffries. This, I feel like, elevates this conversation a bit happening here in Maryland, that a big figure in Washington, D.C. made his way to the Maryland State House to argue about something that's happening internally within the state. What do you think the impact of Hakeem Jeffries showing up and making the case for redistricting in Maryland means for this conversation?
Definitely. I think it clearly raised some, it made some waves, to say the least. He met with the governor, he met with the House Democrats to commend them for passing the map, and then he did meet privately with Senator Bill Ferguson, Senate President. That meeting was about 45 minutes long. It was described as very cordial. But ultimately, it didn't change Ferguson's decision. Bill Ferguson said that he believes, in fact, he actually made the argument that he respects Hakeem Jeffries and appreciates his leadership so much that he wants to keep Jeffries in the majority party. So his argument, again, is that if Maryland does pass this new congressional map, that it could be court tested and then the courts could redraw a new map that could give more seats to Republicans and therefore keep Hakeem Jeffries as the minority leader instead of potentially Speaker of the House. So Ferguson is arguing that keeping Maryland out of this arms race could actually benefit Hakeem Jeffries in the long run. Of course, that's not Jeffries' interpretation. He's arguing that Maryland should join the fight. He's argued for other Democratic states to rejoin this redistricting fight. In his words, to keep President Donald Trump and Republicans from, quote, rigging the election.
And so this is, you know, the lines have been drawn, for lack of a better term, that Senate President Bill Ferguson is saying, I do not want to draw a new map in Maryland. Governor Wes Moore and his allies are saying, we do want a new map in Maryland. Obviously, Hakeem Jeffries, as we just said, is coming down to make his case in favor of Wes Moore's position, saying we want to do this redistricting map. And the debate around redistricting on a national level seems to have taken two sides. One of those sides is we need to do this, at least for the Democratic Party. We need to do this because the Republicans are trying to rig the rules so that they can have a more favorable 2026 election than maybe they would have if they weren't going outside the bounds of congressional and election norms. And we as Democrats need to fight fire with fire. The argument against that, by and large, has been we can't break the rules just because they are. The rules matter. And if we abandon the rules, then it's just going to be a race to the bottom. But it seems like Senate President Bill Ferguson is taking a different approach, where he's not making a more constitutional and moral and ethical argument that we're seeing play out more on the national stage. He's taking more of a legal argument. And you touched on that a little bit. Can you expand a little bit more on what Senate President Bill Ferguson's legal concerns are behind introducing a new map here in Maryland that would oust the one lone Republican, Andy Harris?
Yes. As you mentioned, Ferguson, I do want to be clear, has been very vocal about that argument, as well as where he is trying to say that it's going to be a race to the bottom, right? And if Republicans are going to break the rules, that doesn't mean Democrats should break the rules. But he has had to pivot to that in a sense because there's been such a pressure campaign against him. I think that in his justifications, they've become more technical. And yes, that relates to this legal argument. So Maryland's congressional filing deadline, so the deadline for candidates who want to file for Congress, that's actually tomorrow, February 24th at 9 p.m. And Ferguson has said that the Attorney General, Anthony Brown of Maryland, has made the case that in order for litigation to play out, which we know will happen because Republicans have already said, if this new map is passed, we will sue it. In order for litigation to play out, he said it takes roughly 120 days. It's actually 120 days exactly right now until the primary. So there is, in theory, some time. But Ferguson's argument is that filing is already underway. Maps are already drawn. You know, these people are filing for district lines that could be volatile based on this map, and that could lead to more problems. Additionally, this gets a little technical, but Ferguson is arguing that if the new map is passed and then legally challenged, this 8-0 map, courts could strike down that map and then trigger our current map that's currently 7-1 to also be challenged. And therefore, the courts would say, there's not enough time for you to rework this. We're going to draw it ourselves. And that is where Ferguson is concerned. They could redraw it and it could become a 6-2 map or even 5-3. So again, Ferguson is arguing that let's be happy with the 7 Democrats we're sending to Congress. We don't want the legal challenges. And he keeps saying that the window of opportunity is, quote, closed. Of course, Governor Wes Moore, other top Democrats, Hakeem Jeffries, former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, a Maryland congressman, they're all saying that they don't agree with that legal interpretation. But that's what it really comes down to is, you know, the only way to know is to send it to court.
Bill Ferguson telling people the grass might not be as green as you think on the other side of this debate. You mentioned a couple people that are unhappy with Bill Ferguson's stance on this. Senator Arthur Ellis spoke to Fox 45's Mackenzie Frost earlier this month, and here's what he had to say on this debate.
And one man, the Senate president, said, hell no, it's going to die, I'm going to kill it. Unilaterally will not get a hearing. will not get public testimony, not get a vote, and I will kill that sucker single-handedly. My charge is no one single man have that power in a democracy. That is dictatorship. That's Cuba. That's Castro. And folks talk about protecting democracy from President Trump. Well, we have to protect democracy here from Bill Ferguson.
Extremely strong words yes. coming from Arthur Ellis right there, comparing Senate President Bill Ferguson to Cuban dictator Fidel Castro, one of the most notorious dictators in the history of the world. Very, very strong, heated words coming from Arthur Ellis there. But I do think that it speaks to how seriously people are taking this issue down in the State House in Annapolis. I'm curious from your perspective, somebody who is in Annapolis a whole lot, especially over the past few weeks, couple months, can you speak a little bit to Arthur Ellis's role in this? He's probably been the most vocal person behind Governor Wes Moore when it comes to this issue of redistricting. Can you speak to what his position has been and why you think he's been so vocal about it?
Absolutely, yeah. So Senator Ellis is the only Democratic senator that has been so vocal about his opposition to Senate President Bill Ferguson not taking this for a vote. They are, as you said, and as we heard, incredibly strong words. But I do want to note that no other Democrat has joined him in this protest. Democratic senators, I should clarify. But another key point here, though, is that Arthur Ellis did just file for Congress. And so there are some implications here on Arthur Ellis is trying to, you know, build a voting base, you know, hit some key talking points. And so there is that element here. We are in an election year. Of course, there's that. But he does seem to be standing kind of on his own still at this point. He is not taking quorum votes out of protest for this. But in order for this map to pass in the Senate, they need 29 votes because there's a constitutional amendment attached. There are 34 Democrats. In order to force a vote, they would need at least 16 votes to go against Bill Ferguson. Ferguson and sources familiar with that 34-member Democratic caucus have all maintained that there are not even close to 16 votes to petition the bill out of committee. So Arthur Ellis really does seem to be standing on his own legs here. There are plenty of other top Democrats that are making the case, but as far as Democratic senators that where this actually really matters, you know, on who gets to make the decision, they're all really standing in line and saying we're backing Bill Ferguson's decision.
My name is Gabe Ortiz, speaking right now with WIPR State House reporter Sarah Petrowich, doing great reporting down in Annapolis. I know it's exhausting, so thank you so much for doing that reporting. One more question before I let you get out of here. Let the people know how they can stay up to date with all the great stuff that you're doing in the State House, not just for the General Assembly, but even beyond.
Absolutely. The best way is just check out our website, WIPR.org. I've got reporting almost daily out there for you. Download our app. You can get those updates. And just make sure to check out the Maryland Politics section and see what I'm reporting on.
Awesome stuff coming from Sarah. Keep working hard down at the State House. I'm very glad that I don't have to do that work, but I'm very glad as well that you are up for it, you are ready for it, and you've been doing a great job since you came here to Maryland and WIPR. So thank you so much.
Definitely. Some would call it fulfilling. I'm doing my due diligence. Thank you so much, Gabe.
Coming up next on WIPR, a majority of Washington County in Western Maryland voted to elect President Donald Trump. Now some locals are pushing back on an ICE detention facility coming to their backyards. WIPR's health reporter Scott Massioni has a story on the other side of a quick break. I'm WIPR's Gabe Ortiz. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your local NPR news station.
Welcome back into Midday. My name's Gabe Ortiz. Just wrapped up a great conversation with WIPR State House reporter Sarah Petrowich. If you missed that or any part of the show today, you can go listen back after we wrap up on the WIPR app or at WIPR.org. Right now, we are joined by WIPR reporter Scott Massioni. As Washington County residents in Western Maryland voted 2-3 to elect President Donald Trump in 2024, now amid a surge of federal immigration enforcement, the Department of Homeland Security is looking to build an immigrant detention facility. But some residents in a nearby town are pushing back against the idea. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Great to be here.
So tell us a little bit, just a recap. What is this facility? Where is it going to be? How is it going to be used?
Yeah, so this is in Hagerstown. It's right outside of Hagerstown, actually in a place called Williamsport. And this facility was a former warehouse. It's about 825,000 square feet. The DHS bought it for about $102 million in January. However, they didn't really do anything in terms of letting anyone know. And in fact, the Washington County commissioners kind of were taken by surprise that this had been bought by the federal government. So by buying this, the federal government can skirt some state rules in building this detention facility. And we're seeing that there is a lot of pushback in the local community.
And an update that we got today came from Attorney General Brown here in Maryland. He said, quote, "The Trump administration will stop at nothing to pursue its extreme immigration agenda, including breaking the law. DHS purchases facility while keeping the state and the public in the dark, spending more than $100 million in federal taxpayer dollars without performing the required environmental review and without giving Maryland or Marylanders any voice in the process. We will not allow this administration to treat laws like suggestions and threaten our people or their communities." So a very strongly worded statement there coming from Attorney General Brown here in Maryland. Can you talk about some of the action that we should expect to follow those words?
Yeah, and this is breaking news right now. Attorney General Anthony Brown has sued the Department of Homeland Security to stop the construction of this immigrant detention facility. What he said is that the DHS did not do the proper environmental assessments and also did not ask for any public comment, as I was just saying. So one of the things that he said about this is that a facility this size would generate 4 times more wastewater than the site was designed for. It's risking sewage overflows and property backups for people in the surrounding areas. There'd be increased traffic, air quality impacts, the burden on local emergency services that were never assessed. So this town is, going to have an extra 1,500 people. Western Maryland's not that large. It's going to be a burden for these towns and the surrounding areas. People are worried about their property values. All these things are going to impact it. And then he also mentioned that there could be health impacts within these facilities that they may not be able to address. We've seen outbreaks of measles within some ICE facilities. So this is something that's going to hold up the works possibly for DHS as they're building this. We don't really know yet what's happening. This is all happening, like we said, very quickly and sort of breaking news right now. But at this point, we know that the state is suing the White House over this. We don't know what impact it'll have, however, on the timeline of this construction. And we have heard that the White House could move this forward within a matter of months in terms of converting this warehouse into a detention facility.
And when we look at this lawsuit from Attorney General Brown, is this something that has the potential for success, or even rather, what does success look like according to the Attorney General in terms of this lawsuit? Is it to get this facility out of Maryland as soon as possible? Is it to just delay the building as much as they possibly can? What do you think that the Attorney General is hoping to get out of this lawsuit?
I think at this point, what they're trying to do is at least delay it, possibly stop it. So without looking at the possibility for things like, wastewater pollution, how it'll help how it'll hurt the surrounding areas, these cities, there's an undue burden being put on Maryland. And like I said, I'm not a lawyer, but that I think that's the case that he's trying to make here, is that Maryland is being burdened by the federal government, and they need to at least slow their roll here before they can build this facility. And that will at least buy them some time to maybe negotiate with the government, possibly stop this from being actually built, or have the state legislature, which has a handful of bills right now in there trying to address these detention centers, kind of figure out what they want to do and possibly put a hindrance on the building of this facility as well. So we know that Anthony Brown doesn't want this facility in there at all. However, he's doing everything in his power to at least slow it down, if not stop it if possible.
And not only are Marylanders potentially being burdened by this thing that they didn't have a whole lot of say in, but they're being burdened by something that is widely unpopular here in Maryland. This surge that we've seen in immigration enforcement is something that Marylanders have already had to experience, granted in smaller doses than maybe some other states across the country have. But can you speak a little bit, to the best of your knowledge, how Marylanders feel about this facility potentially being put there? Not so much from a legal standpoint, but more so from a cultural standpoint and from a political standpoint.
Yeah, Yeah, well, I mean, we've already seen a handful of counties and local jurisdictions make whatever they can out of stopping ICE from coming into their communities, stopping any sort of cooperation with local law enforcement and ICE. We've seen Baltimore City do this. We've seen Howard County do it. We've seen, I think, Prince George's County do it. So there's many local jurisdictions that are doing everything within their local power to say, we're not going to work with ICE. We're not going to turn over data. Now, Washington County is a bit of an outlier within Maryland. They voted 60% for Trump in 2024. However, we've seen extreme pushback on this ICE facility within the area. We've seen petitions go up with thousands of signatures, people protesting outside of the county commissioners' meetings. And these county commissioners did not allow people to speak during their meeting on they had a recent vote just to support ICE and what they're doing in building this facility. They did not allow people to speak, and they had protesters interrupt that meeting because of it.
My name is Gabe Ortiz, speaking right now with WYPR health reporter Scott Massioni, discussing the newest developments, including some breaking news regarding the potential ICE detention facility being built in Western Maryland. Attorney General Anthony Brown is bringing a lawsuit against the federal government in regards to the process that went down to build this site in Western Maryland. Potential delays could come. Maybe it won't be in Maryland. We'll still have to see how this plays out. This is breaking and developing news. I want to transition to another story that you've been working on here at WYPR, and it has to do with Maryland lawmakers floating taxing social media companies over mental health. Now, this is a story that has been going on for years now, since the dawn of social media. Mm-hmm. How is this affecting people, and especially how is it affecting young people? We're now seeing here in Maryland that lawmakers may be taking legal action to have some kind of balance between social media companies, the effect they have on mental health, and as I just said, young people, and how they have to pay it forward, for lack of a better term, right, in regards to that. So can you talk a little bit about this potential bill and what really goes into it?
Yeah, it's a little complicated in how they would do this, because it's like, you know, how does a single state tax a large social media company that has reaches all over the world? And so what they would do, this bill would require social media companies with more than 1 million monthly users or $500 million in annual revenue to pay a tax to Maryland. Now, that tax would go specifically into a fund that would help children's health, and that would, you know, help people get access to mental health. It would pay for things like counselors, for things like school counselors. The bill comes at a time when social media companies are really under fire for the impact of the mental health that they've had. And we've seen that social media has caused things like depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, cyberbullying for people who are under the age of 18. So this could be something that could significantly change how states can deal and push back against how social media companies are operating within their jurisdiction.
And it's a very tough issue, because I think a lot of older folks like to just say, well, just tell these kids to get off the phone, right? Tell these kids to get off Twitter, to get off Instagram, to get off TikTok, to any app that, you know, is popping up nowadays. But I think something that gets lost in that conversation is a lot of the people saying that had lives, sometimes very long lives, in a world without social media. Mm-hmm. And these young folks, they don't know the world without it. It's not as easy as just, well, I'm going to put my phone down, because they've been on their phone for their entire lives. They've been on these apps for their entire lives. And so I see this as a way to balance out what's going on, right? That there needs to be some kind of common ground between telling kids to get off social media entirely and letting these social media companies just run rampant with 100% of these young people's attention. When we look to the near future of this bill, what would you say the success that it passes is, and what form would that actually come in? You talked a little bit about how complicated it would be to actually implement this, but what's the success level of this? What are the odds?
I think that there could be some possible support for this. We saw that President Biden's Surgeon General had, you know, talked about possibly putting warning labels on social media for children. There's other countries that have gone much further. Australia banned social media for people under the age of 16 last year. And, you know, one of the other things about social media, you just talked about, you know, it's easy for some people to say, put your phone down. However, it's becoming more and more integrated in everyone's lives. And you know, think about how you have to sign into, I don't know, any account these days. You know, you can always just click, you know, sign in with Facebook or sign in with Instagram. So it's not as easy as just, you know, putting it down. You know, if you need to watch a video on, I don't know, how to, you know, remodel your bathroom or whatever, you're getting on social media. So it's really hard to not stay informed as a citizen and also stay away from social media at this point. It's a real double-edged sword.
My name is Gabe Ortiz, speaking right now with WYPR health reporter Scott Massioni about potential tax law coming into play here in Maryland that will affect how social media companies can reach young people and the taxes they're going to have to pay for the potential effects they have on mental health for young folks here in Maryland. Scott, before I let you get out of here, thank you so much for your time today. Let the people know how they can stay up to date with all the reporting you're doing.
That's right. You can always come here to 88.1 FM, WYPR.org, and you can follow our Instagram that we have. Speaking of social media, we have a few videos up there talking about the recent stories we've been doing.
Head over to WYPR's Instagram. We're only going to affect your mental health in a positive way. We're trying to bring you some news, keep you informed. It's a great place to get short form news media over at WYPR 88.1 FM. Or as Scott said, you can join us right here on the radio every single day. My name's Gabe Ortiz. If you missed any part of the show, you can go listen back on the WYPR app or at WYPR.org. Tom will be back tomorrow speaking with Isabel Cumming, talking about everything going on in the mayor's office and the flow of information through the city.
You're listening to 88.1 WYPR, your local NPR news station.